Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake. I'm with the New Books Network, and today we are joined by Andrew T. Feedy, who is the author of Homicide Justified, The Legality of Killing Slaves in the United States and the Atlantic World. He is a lawyer in private practice in northern New Jersey, and since 1986, he has been an adjunct professor of law at Montclair State University. And full disclosure, he is also a colleague of mine at Montclair State, where we're in the political science and law department together. I know him as Andy. So, Andy, welcome to New Books in Law podcast. It is a pleasure, and you are the author of other books in regard to American slavery, entitled Roadblocks to Freedom, Slavery and the Manumission in the United States South, and People Without Rights, An Interpretation of the Fundamentals of the Law of Slavery in the U.S. South. But what we're going to discuss today is your latest book. It was published in 2017 by the University of Georgia Press, and it's called Homicide Justified. And this is about essentially how masters were legally able to treat their slaves, and in what were the consequences for the masters and others when slaves were intentionally killed. What brought you to this element of slave treatment? In other words, why do you think this was deserving of a book-length treatment?
Well, when I started looking into the law of slavery back in law school, I focused on initially violence, both fatal and non-fatal violence. And the reason I looked at that is because that is one of the key elements of how slave owners kept control over those who were enslaved. The topic of homicide is something that I came back to with this most recent book because I wanted to do a comparative approach to look at how this law varied in different slaveholding places and times and see if we could, through that comparison, have a better understanding of slavery, the law of slavery, homicide, and also how law changes from time to time as society changes. So by taking this one issue and focusing across a broad band of time and space, I tried to come up with a clearer outline than you could get from looking at just one specific place and time, as I did earlier. My earlier focus was on the antebellum South and the southern states' laws and court decisions dealing with both, as I said, fatal and non-fatal violence. I put the two together. Here I picked out the issue of homicide, and I broadened the scope in the hopes of coming up with some new understandings of similarities and differences over time and space.
So early on in the book, you do some comparative analysis in terms of different types of regimes that had slaves, and you make this distinction between what you call, or you're borrowing, for, as you note in the book, from H.S. Maine's concept of a status society versus a contract society. Can you explain that distinction?
Yes, I thought that was very helpful in terms of sorting out the different approaches. And what I did is I put it in terms of a continuum from a status society being what we might call a primitive or tribal society. Now it's maybe more correct to call it a small society. I've seen that in the recent literature, in which you have no courts, you have no written law. Instead, customs govern how the people interrelate within a tribe and between tribes. And so in this regard, you have one end of the continuum. On the other end, the forest end, you would have a more modern society where you have an elaborate court system, lawyers with specialized training, judges, legislators, written or unwritten constitutions governing all of this, and a very formalized system, which is different, but as we see, addressing the same issues. What do you do when someone kills someone else? How is crime deterred? How is it punished? And what are the consequences for both the victims' families and the victims? So that was the continuum. I looked at it as a continuum rather than he looks at it more as a matter of progress from one form to the other. I look at it more as a continuum that you could have in this place at different times. We had basically the whole range of continuum. In other places, maybe not. And that's why you can still find societies today operating under what we might call the small society system of unwritten laws and customs.
Yeah, so Maine would see this as a progression over time, kind of a Whig view of history that you go from simplicity to complexity and more formal legal relations. Whereas it seems to me that, especially in analyzing this in the context of slavery, you can have a status society at one end and a contract society at the other end, but both of them have slavery, right?
Yes, exactly. That's correct. And so that's why I put the antebellum South more on the contract end, whereas if we looked at the Native American slavery or if we look at slavery in Northern Europe, you can find it's on the status end before written laws were relied upon. So, yes, I think that's correct.
So you compare the different areas as slave or there are these terms of art that historians are familiar with. But and so I want to unpack them a little bit. There is the notion of societies with slaves versus slave societies, kind of a hyphenated term, slave societies. Can you explain, you embrace this somewhat. Can you explain the distinction there?
I do, even though I know among some historians it's a bit controversial, especially recently. Apparently some are questioning it, but it was helpful to me, again, in sorting out the different evidence that I found. A society with slaves would be a society in which the slaves are a part of the economy, a part of the social fabric, but only one part. And generally speaking, the population is smaller. Could be 10% of the population, could be as much as 20, depending on the society. And that would be typical of slavery, let's say, in the northern colonies in North America and New England, the middle Atlantic states, even including New York and New Jersey. Although there you begin to see the transition into what is called the slave society, which would be a society where slaves make up a larger percentage of the population and are much more integrated into all aspects of the economy and society, and ending in the plantation societies, where you would have a very large percentage of enslaved people working under the direction of a small number of free, unenslaved people, if you will. And slavery is so integral to the economy and society that people can't imagine a world without it. And that's what I would contrast as being the southern states, especially in the years up to the Civil War, where people became so, slavery became so ingrained in the society that there was no way to think of beyond it. And it's so integral, not only to the economics, but also to both the religious and intellectual thought process. In other words, the pro-slavery ideology arose in the southern states, became more and more widespread, based upon the idea of racism and that slavery was so that's why I consider that to be a useful concept, at least in terms of sorting out when you're doing a comparative approach, as I have done here.
And in addition, one area you haven't really mentioned yet is, of course, the Caribbean and the British possessions there. Historians have treated the distinctions not only geographically, but also really in terms of the prospects for slaves and this slave society versus society with slaves concept, even more deeply in the Caribbean, right?
Yes. Yeah, I devoted a whole chapter to that because I thought it would be the best way to handle it. Other than with a few exceptions, those were classic examples of what I would call a society that was a slave society with very large enslaved populations, 80% of the population or more on these various islands, and mostly the sugar economy, where sugar was the crop that could be grown based upon all the conditions of soil and, you know, rainfall and so forth, temperature. So in those colonies, yes, those are probably some of the most extreme examples on, again, a continuum, if you will, from a society with only a few slaves, maybe in Canada, for example, where you might have a few slaves involved. Exactly, the southern states, the Caribbean, the plantations that many people view as the only example of slavery, but slavery is very diverse. And that's one of the points I was trying to make, show how slave societies were diverse. Did the law diverge as well?
And okay, and so that's where we get to the specific topic that you want to address, which is homicide, this intentional and sometimes negligent killing of another person, in particular slaves. So the conventional understanding of slavery and the prospects that one faced as a slave for how long you would live and the conditions of your life, you start in the North, and what we're talking about, of course, your main concern, and I want to talk about some of the other types of societies that you reference in comparison, but mainly you're concerned with American British colonies and then later states. So we start all the way north in the furthest northern British colonies, where it's hard being a slave no matter what, but it's certainly comparatively easier if you're in Boston than if you're in Barbados, right?
I think that's a fair statement. Neither is in any way desirable, but I think that's true. And it has to do with quality of life in terms of things that can be measured, I think, such as life expectancy, but also in the law. And that's why when I looked for statutes dealing with slave homicides in the northern states and Canada, I found that there wasn't as much evidence indicating that the common law was, at least in theory, the law that would be applied if a master or a third party killed a slave.
Okay, so let's talk about those specific formal laws, or what we call positive law, a law that's on the books. How does it vary from location to location? And let's start at the earliest period before we start talking about the states. Let's talk about it when it's only colonial possessions. What's it like in colonial Boston versus colonial Virginia and then somewhere in the Caribbean?
Well, yeah, I essentially broke it down into three categories in the in the northern states and colonies, I should say, later states. The general pattern was that the common law of homicide was applied by default because in English law in England, slavery had just more or less disappeared for hundreds of years, and so if you were to look up in the law books for a statute or case, what do we do if we have a case of homicide involving a slave? Well, we wouldn't find anything because there were no precedents, there were no statutes. And so at least in those jurisdictions, it would seem you would have the common law applied. And as you move further south, you find that there were different approaches. In Virginia, for example, various statutes were passed in the colonial times, carving out certain areas of privilege where owners would have the right to kill slaves. Third parties would if slaves were runaways. And that's what you found. That was a bit different. Certainly what happened in South Carolina was more typical. That's the third pattern, with Barbados being the first of the British colonies in the Caribbean, where you have a complete code essentially decriminalizing slave homicide and providing only for a fine for the most extreme examples of willful killings with no excuse, no reason. And so that would be what I would call the most extreme example as we look at the Atlantic system going from, again, a slave society in the Caribbean and South Carolina, which pretty much copies some of the concepts from the Caribbean, to the northern colonies, which were societies with slaves.
So what are the motives for the whites that live and govern in the Caribbean to allow for murder, but at the same time have some legal concerns about how the law treats murder and other types of cruel behavior towards slaves?
Well, that's another excellent question, because if you define slaves as property, as they did, then you would think that simply a matter of a civil lawsuit would be adequate for a person to sue to recover damages. In other words, if you killed my slave, I could sue you and recover the market value of that slave as found by a jury, for example. And of course, if I killed my own slave, well, that would be my loss and it would be my choice. The idea seems to be that there are certain extremes of violence on the far end that society nevertheless wants to punish in some way. And in the early Barbados Code from 1661, it's a matter of fines. Now, there were certain offenses that were exempted from fines. In other words, owners had more power over their slaves than any other. But yes, there was a possibility that that there could be fines and damages recovered. And this is significant because I think the idea going back to the earlier chapters in the book, as I show, is that there's a recognition that extremes of violence could lead to resentment among slaves, could lead to rebellion, and could lead to other undesirable things that in a society like this, where slavery is so important, that cooler heads prevail, and there are certain limits beyond which an owner can't go in order for the better preservation and continuation of this type of regime. So order is the term I use also. There's an orderly oppression that has to be maintained.
And so, in other words, this seems to be a policing, as it were, by what are seen as, so, and these would be perhaps self-described as responsible slave owners and governors, rulers, trying to rein in the more egregious examples of the white ruling class who would simply willy-nilly abuse their slaves. In other words, they fear the fringes of the white class who would willfully abuse and murder their slaves, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I found evidence of that as well when I looked at the ancient Roman laws, which I found to be helpful in this regard, because in ancient Rome, the emperors did impose certain limitations on slave owners, in theory, punishing them for wanton, willful, brutal slave killings for no reason whatsoever. And I found in some of the texts a similar type of explanation, explicitly stating that, we can't have, slaves are so important that we can't leave them to the ultimate discretion, unlimited discretion of owners. There have to be some limits. And the other thing they recognize is the harm to the heirs, the explicit recognition of this, that, if you let a deranged slave owner kill his or her slave. You're depriving the heirs, rightful heirs, of that property to their inheritance. So there is actually this economic and I would call social order interest. You know, it's hard for us to think of people in that regard as being looked at as we look at them as crime victims, and of course, rightly so. But one also has to look at the society in which this calculation is being made. And so that's why I thought the Roman law materials were helpful, because I think it's a candid acknowledgement of what is going on, this combination of economics and social control. And so to me, that was helpful in explaining what was going on, for example, in the Caribbean, where the colonists there were basically writing on a blank slate. They were making up the laws they went along because, as I said before, there was no English or British law of slavery that they could draw upon to decide what to do with these cases.
Right. That's important. I think you early in the book, you make mention, of course, of ancient Roman law regarding slaves and the preservation of property. And you even go on into the Middle Ages with the Visigoths and the Spanish Code, the Partidas in the Middle Ages regarding prohibitions on murder of slaves. And so these are societies, obviously, long before the modern period, where we're concerned with individual rights and liberties and what we think of today as humanitarian concerns. So is the lesson to be drawn from these earlier pre-modern examples that you refer to that even in a modern society of the 17th, when I say modern, I mean a society that starts to recognize conceptions of individual liberty and the rights of individuals as separate from the community that need to be protected. Isn't this pre-modern evidence that you refer to in some way revealing of the fact that regardless of modernity and notions of humanitarianism, it's essentially safety and self-preservation of the master class that's motivating these concerns about how we treat slaves. It's not individual liberty.
I'm afraid so, yes. I would like to think, and many of the texts that you read talk about increased sensitivity based on Enlightenment principles or modern principles that motivated these slavery laws that at least on the surface provide some level of protection, okay? But I agree with the way you phrased it, Ian, that when you look back, you see a continuity here, or at least I did, and that's why I thought going back to the Visigoths and even further to ancient Rome and even further to maybe even Native American evidence of that, even further back to the Romans' encounters with the Northern European barbarians, as they thought of them. And you find this continuity that it seems to be part of slavery as it existed throughout history, and that this violence was, again, as much as there was a limitation, there was also a legitimizing effect or legalizing effect, whereby there were areas of violence that were condoned, and so that you wouldn't have to worry if you were a slave owner, if through what was considered moderate correction, you just happened to kill somebody. Whereas if it was an apprentice or somebody working under you, you would be in big trouble. So yes, there was this balance, and the balance seems to have been carried on through the centuries, maybe even millennia. And that's what I think this comparative approach shows.
So what role here does the British government play? They ostensibly have uniform policies that they want to implement throughout their emerging imperial possessions, whether it's in the far northeast of the American littoral or way down in the Caribbean. How do they perceive this?
I found them to be a very interesting, the British colonial control over this, kind of like a a very weak giant. In other words, the colonists were given a wide discretion through their elected assemblies to pass local laws dealing with slavery and race relations. And this was part of the, I guess, the British system or constitution as it related to their empire. And they did not impose an empire-wide slave code, calling upon all of the colonists to comply. And interestingly, that left this wide range of discretion. That's why we have laws ranging from those in the North to the South and the Caribbean, showing a range of responses. Nevertheless, during this period, beginning in the 1680s, the central government supplied all of the colonial governors. Each colony would have a governor to administer the law, and an elected assembly to pass local regulation.
And ostensibly, of course, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Ostensibly, those governors are loyal to the crown and the crown's concerns, whereas we start to get divisions between what the local assemblies want and what the crown officials want.
Right? Yeah, way back, as far back as I said, in 1661 in Barbados. And so, yes, the local colonists pass their version of what they think the law should be. The governors are there to administer those laws. Local laws are sent to the central authorities, who then determine whether they're consistent with the laws of England. What happened was each governor after the 1680s would receive a set of lengthy instructions. And one of them in the slave colonies would be try to persuade these colonists to pass a law making the murder of slaves a capital offense. And the governors would then be sent across the ocean. And for almost 100 years, they failed to persuade the colonists. So this is why I refer to this weak giant. The king and queen and all of their forces are trying to persuade these colonists to make slave murder a capital offense. And they can't convince them. Some of the governors, I think, may have tried more, put more effort into it than others. But they immediately met resistance from the colonists, who at an early date had made up their mind that either slave killing shouldn't be a capital offense, or it shouldn't be on the first offense. And again, I'm distinguishing colonies from Virginia South and in the Caribbean. From the northern colonies. And again, in Virginia is kind of a transition because Virginia had its own way of doing things. It did, in theory, have the possibility of a capital punishment for slave killers. And in fact, there was one example from 1775 of a slave owner. Prior to that, there were non-slave owners. But if you see what I mean, you have this, again, continuum of change, which is a result of the British not imposing a code that simply said to the colonists, "You will punish slave murder as any other kind of murder." They never did that, and so that this process of local law was what governed, and that's what we see. The laws changed over time as the local colonists responded to different concerns.
So one of the questions that cropped up when I read this was, what is it that's motivating the imperial officials? In other words, why is there this seemingly empire? I know it's not a powerful empire yet, but this empire-wide push to reform the treatment of slaves. What motivates that in the post-1660 government in England?
I'm not sure exactly what was motivating them. I think that it may have been just in terms of homicide, at least, a question of, well, why wouldn't you follow the common law? I mean, this is what we follow. You know, this is our law, and this is, you know, this is the law you should apply. There were later reforms, certainly as people began to speak out against slavery. which of course led to the abolition of the slave trade and some controls in the colonies.
But that's much
later,
though.
Much later.
That's much later.
In the 1680s or as soon as this became evident, I don't know what was motivating the crown. But I will say that there were consistent requests made and all through this period for at least that, at least making it a capital crime, so that you wouldn't have a situation as you did where malicious slave killers, you know, for no reason whatsoever, would simply have to pay a fine as the ultimate punishment.
Right, because it was really puzzling to me why there was this push, because ultimately, of course, as you note, in 1696, finally, there is, after much cajoling, repeated urging I think this is Barbados, right, in 1696, where they actually start to pass. It's as if you get one pass when you kill a slave, but on the second murder.
Yeah, well, Jamaica, that's Jamaica, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Jamaica.
Yeah, you get one free shot, and then you get branded as a the next time you would get what would be the punishment the first time, in if you were killing anyone other than a slave. Yeah, and that was the very slow incremental approach, you know. And it is by island. Barbados was the very last, and I think it was 1805, to finally capitulate to the crown and make slave homicide, murder, willful murder, a malicious, malice aforethought, a capital crime. So yes, so you had this slow process where they began to succumb to pressure island by island, over time. And again, what I try to contrast that is with the approach of the Spanish, Portuguese, and French, empires, where what the crown did was impose a slave code on the colonists, which included provisions. And that's the interesting question. Why, if the English crown thought this was equally important, they didn't do the same thing? And I don't know the answer to that. That's would be a very interesting question for further study, further comparison of, you know, the empire building approaches of these two. When I say empire, you know, colonial empires, in a sense that the mother country is exerting much greater control in the other slaveholding empires that I studied.
Okay, so to go back to we've been talking about the motives of the imperial officials, but now the motives of people on the ground, the white slave owners, they are concerned with their own physical safety. So on the one hand, it seems as if there's a dilemma where they don't know just how much leeway they can allow their white brethren. In other words, on the one hand, if they let people become sadistically cruel, albeit, of course, within the context of slavery itself, which is a cruel system, but nevertheless, if they allow people to willy-nilly, without penalty, without any stricture, kill their slaves, the fear is what exactly will result?
Well, the fear is, I suppose, twofold. One is that, again, that causes an economic harm to the heirs. I take that from the Roman texts who thought of that. But I think more important, it was a concern that it would lead to disquiet among the slaves. It would lead to rebellion. It could lead to this in the community. That's when a slave owner is involved, okay? The slave owning legislatures, in this case, at least in some regard, were policing the people who were electing them, and that was I consider to be part of their interest, their calculation of interest, whether it's economic, social, and so forth. But at the same time, they wanted to have a broader scope of liability for others who might kill their slaves. For example, third parties who might wantonly kill a slave for no reason. Obviously, if that person is not able to pay damages, or even if the person can, the owner might want a retribution through the law to punish that person. And later, when you have overseers used, as you do on the plantations, that was another area where there was a constant conflict between overseers who are charged with controlling slaves and slave owners who want to see their slaves managed properly and not killed off, where they would suffer a capital loss in terms of the loss of their most valuable property. So that's why you also see, instead of uniform rules that we normally think of, that everybody's governed by the same law, you see that there were different standards of liability imposed as part of these reforms over time to account for the different interests that occur in a slave society like a plantation society.
So one of the interesting geographic locations is South Carolina, where you've got this, it seems to be this overlapping of, on the one hand, a society with slaves versus a slave society, depending on where you are within the South. And so you've got the Caribbean is essentially a straight out slave society concept where people just cannot imagine what life would be like without many slaves. And they have these huge numbers of slaves, a huge percentage of the population and a growing percentage over the decades. Whereas in South Carolina, if you're in the upland, meaning further inland, versus the lowland along the coast, you really do have in some ways two different functioning economies in regard to slavery, right?
Yeah. Yes, you did. Yeah, there was. And that was somewhat reflected in the chapter I have on South Carolina. South Carolina was the last of the states at that point, slash colonies, states, to finally put slave murder, at least potentially as a capital crime. And that was in 1821, even after Barbados. So because of that, there was a long history of lobbying and a legislative history, if you will, that I have in that chapter, in which we have a pretty good record of what the arguments that were being made. And it does seem that some of the arguments were coming from more interior portions, that the law needs to be reformed. This is an outrage, and we need to join now with everyone else, including the other British colonies, the British colonies, and make slave murder a capital offense. And the evidence of that came from newspapers, from grand jury presentments, and other documents. After each of these terrible murders, there would seem to be a newspaper article or something calling for this. And of course, the reforms would fail. And so so South Carolina provides an interesting example. Maybe it's because of that split in the way the society is set up and governed. But ultimately, the slave owners had the control and were able to fend off these reform efforts again for about, until 1821. And finally, they capitulated.
So these reform efforts, and when we talk about reform, what we're talking about is essentially some type of, it's essentially, as you've described earlier, there is no quote unquote slave law until the locals make it themselves, because there's no prepared on the shelf British imperial slave law. It's unlike the French and the Spanish. It's really a law that's going to be made locally, and hence the standards are going to vary from place to place.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what's behind everything I'm saying is this, this lack of central control and this local control, which can reflect the different calculations of the interests involved in different places and times. So, yes.
And so these reform efforts, though, they're being pushed by the central government ever since the Restoration government from 1660s onward, and really it starts to, I guess, speed up and become more repetitive and a more uniform push by the 1680s and 90s. But eventually there are going to be these reform efforts that are even taken on by the local governors, they're imperial, allegiant to the empire, but at the same time, they do apparently push these things. And so eventually there are reforms. What seems to be the catalyst for it, other than the governor wanting it? Is it a fear of rebellion that seems to make these people in the local legislatures who are elected slave owners themselves? Is it fear of mistreatment starting to be reflected in attitudes of the slaves? What seems to be the motive then for people who are willing to start to adopt reforms?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of motives. I do think that those economic, social control issues are predominant. I think that that's part of it. It may also be that some people were motivated by, and I'll put it in quotes, humanitarian concerns, that they felt that slavery, if it was not wrong, it should nevertheless be a subject of regulation by the government, just like any other type of regulation, but appropriate regulation that would recognize the superior rights of slave owners, while at the same time recognizing their economic interests. I also think that with the stratification of society, I think this is probably the most important point, that we begin with the concept of the idea that it's whites, slave owners, versus blacks who are slaves. And what happens over time as plantation societies, or even non-plantation but complex societies develop, you have stratification within the white class. And you have the elite slave owners, you have middling and small slave owners, non-slave owners, what people call poor white trash. And, you know, within that white structure, the slave owners felt, well, we have to control these people. We need laws that are going to punish and deter these people from harming our slaves. And often that was, I think, what was motivating these reforms. And so on the one hand, they look humanitarian, and maybe some were motivated by that. On the other hand, I think some were concerned about controlling the white underclass, and also the overseers, candidly, who were now becoming more and more essential, if you will, as slave society was developing in these regions. So then the dilemma becomes, well, okay, let's make it a capital crime, but then what about us being the slave owners? What about us? Well, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll only punish the very extremes. We'll allow masters explicitly in some places, not explicitly in others, a free pass if they kill a slave as a result of moderate correction, if the slave is rebellious, or if the slave is an outlaw as defined. That was the North Carolina approach. And by carving out areas where there was impunity for slave killing for slave owners, they were able to set up a maybe three-tier system where slave owners faced the least liability, overseers and faced middle level, and then third parties who have no relation would be the most susceptible to punishment. And this you can view as a protection of property, as a protection of order, and therefore when the slave owner gets to that extreme level, where there's no reason whatsoever for what he has done or she has done, only in that case would there be the potential for punishment. And so when you look at that in that regard, I think it's a mixture of motives.
So changing to a somewhat different subject now, it seems to me that one of the difficulties that all legal historians face is you've got positive law, meaning law that's been enacted, it's on the books, and sometimes you even have court decisions that reflect the enforcement of it. But at the same time, it's hard to know when and how often that positive law is actually implemented, how often it's actually enforced. So in this particular context with slave homicide, what were some of the problems and that you encountered with evidence of enforcement?
Yeah, that's a very big problem, and I'm very sensitive to that. Just because there's a law on the books doesn't mean it, in practice that law is enforced or that it's even effective. And I always use the example of driving on the turnpike. If I try to drive the speed limit on the turnpike, I'm practically driven off the road. So in 100 years from now, when people will look at the speed limit laws, they will assume everybody drove 65 miles an hour when they had cars back in the day. And of course, we know that's not true. So why should, when we look at slavery law 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, we have to keep the same concern in mind. Do these laws that we have evidence of reflect the actual practice? The best we can do is just look at the evidence we have. And in the antebellum years, there are a number of reported cases in the appellate courts that show cases were tried, people were convicted, and there also is evidence from newspaper articles and other sources of trials to at least get some sense of how, who was prosecuted, were those prosecutions successful, and to try to come to some at least general understanding. But yeah, crime statistics, if you will, are very hard to really quantify during this period, to really know whether these laws on the books were meaningful or not. And that's one of the arguments that's been made over the years, that, oh, well, you know, these slave owners, they were people better than their laws. You know, they put these laws on the books. They may seem harsh. They may seem cruel, but, you know, they treated their slaves well. And we all knew that. And those laws are there just as a basically a stopgap, you know, and for extreme cases. But no owner would willingly kill his or her own slave, you know, and so forth. So, you know, that's the one argument on the one side. And so I try to look at the actual examples that we have to see, well, who was prosecuted, who was executed, and how many of these cases resulted in either, you know, the slave owner getting a small penalty or no penalty. And so I think what I found is that you have to look at the case law, and you have to look at the at these other sources to get a picture. And so at least there's some evidence during this period of prosecutions. And that's what I tried to put in the later chapters of the book to shed some light on how the statutes were actually enforced.
And so when we do in fact get prosecutions of owners who kill slaves, and the distinction you made earlier, third parties, non-owners, whether they are overseers or complete strangers to the slave owner, what are the results typically?
Well, typically, as I had kind of alluded to before, the third parties face the highest likelihood of prosecution, a successful prosecution. And I use the example of North Carolina there as a better example, because the case law there is starts in the 1790s when we have reported cases. And the first cases deal with third parties and overseers, as you might suspect, killing slaves. The first North Carolina person who was executed for killing a slave was a third party, and that caused quite an uproar, because even though the law had been passed making slave killing a capital crime, again with the carve out for slave owners, there was great controversy about whether that law should ever be enforced. And in fact, it eventually was. I tell the whole story there as these cases developed. So, yes, that would be the first step. That would show that there would be the widest liability there. You then get to overseers, and there are cases involving overseers in all of the states, I believe. And then finally, the most difficult question is the slave owner or slave owner's family member, close family members, whether they should be prosecuted, if at all, and just what is the outer limit of what we would call moderate or necessary correction, or what they call moderate or necessary correction. So that's kind of the spectrum of liability. And I think that the sources in the book show that.
And so in addition to the difficulty of prosecution, whether to prosecute or not, there are also some real evidentiary limits on any would-be prosecution in terms of the witnesses, because most of the time, a lot of the witnesses are probably going to be other slaves, but there's some real severe limitations on how useful they can be, right?
Oh, yes. That's one of the things that makes all of this so so difficult for prosecutors, if you will, I think, in terms of actually getting convictions. So this is one of the main principles of evidence law, that enslaved people could not testify. Even free blacks, in many instances, were prohibited from testifying against whites. So you would have to have white people who were witnesses, who had seen something that they were willing to complain about because they felt it so crossed the line, and that even getting the case prosecuted would be then a chore. And then, of course, proving the case in court would be yet another example. And that's why I started the first chapter out with taking an actual case and looking at it, a trial from start to finish, to try to illustrate for the readers how slavery law worked, under the theory "show them, don't tell them," and to show how the end result. I won't give it away, so someone might want to read the book. I try to turn it into a story to try to illustrate how some of the conceptions we have of law and how the process works, how there were deviations there, and so certainly evidential. And as I say, the standards that were applied, because, again, just to switch to North Carolina, those cases very explicitly, through common law development, modified the standards of mitigation and extenuation, which for lay readers might not understand how important that is. But for lawyers, that's extremely important, meaning when does a crime go from justified homicide to manslaughter, where you have a lesser penalty, to murder, where you have the ultimate penalty. And what the judges did, more or less on their own, is decided, well, we're going to modify the standards we normally apply. We're going to, because it's slavery, because it's race, we think we can do this. And they did, to therefore make it more likely that white defendants would either be free of punishment or would get a lesser punishment. Again, explicitly dealing with race and class, where this was law they were making up. This was not something that was a precedent from England. These are I think very interesting developments that show how the law can be very pliable, flexible, both statute and common law, when the elites in a society are able to have their way, as they did in colonial and then later the antebellum years.
So here's a curveball question. Tell me something that really surprised you in researching and writing this book.
Well, I was surprised by the difference between the colonial regimes, comparing England, for example, and the other empires, France and so forth, with slave codes being imposed. That was something that I was just not aware of. And so that was new to me, because I had focused on the British colonies here in North America, primarily. And the other thing, as I would say, is this what I see as a continuity, going back to ancient Rome and maybe even before, of this idea, which is that violence is so inherent a part of slavery that we have to have these carve out areas where slave owners are free to abuse and even kill their slaves in cases where, even in other forms of inequality, husband and wife, indentured servants and masters, where we don't excuse it. So, yes, difference and continuity, I guess, would be those the two things that surprised me.
Well, the book is Homicide Justified, The Legality of Killing Slaves in the United States and the Atlantic World. And we've been joined today by its author, Andrew T. Feedy. Andy, thank you so much for joining me on New Books in Law podcast.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure. And thank you again for the opportunity.